those old operations. Kuga, like a ghost, slipped away. We had no photo of him, no physical description, no hard details at all. Even his nickname, though Bosnian, did not mean that he was, in fact, from Bosnia. Kuga used and shed so many disguises that no one knew one thing for certain about him. Hell, he could even be a she, not a he. We simply did not know. Bug's team has pieced together a whole slew of cover names Kuga uses around the world. Marad in the Middle East, Kasalik in Uzbekistan, Izuria in the Basque region, Chuma in Bulgaria, Maras in Lithuania, Veba in Turkey. All of them are variations of plague. Kuga. The plague. A merchant of death. Hell's concierge. Fuck. If he was now vending high-end bioweapons to Assad, it meant that things in Syria were about to go from bad to really fucking worse. And it was too soon to tell if our raid on Almasi and the subsequent liberation of Astrid Jacobson was going to substantially derail Kuga's plans. If so, that would be a nice Christmas present to the world. Kuga, I said. Damn. Ghost opened his eyes, caught my mood, and came over to put his big white head on my lap. Sensing my distress, he then wanted comfort from me. I obligingly scratched his neck, but my thoughts lingered on Kuga. About a man who was so clever and so elusive that not even Bug, with all the resources of the world's most powerful computer system, was able to locate him. As we flew back to Greece, I should have been happy, relieved that a mission had gone off so well with no harm to Astrid or her father or to my team. I should have been comforted in the knowledge of a job well done, and yet I was not. Bunny's playlist had left Elvis behind and was now playing I Heard the Bells on Christmas Day, which is the most downbeat holiday song I know. Well, maybe the Coventry Carol tops that list, but so far, Bunny was two for two with stuff that depressed the hell out of me. I tried not to listen to the lyrics, which were based on a Civil War poem by Longfellow, but the cabin was soundproof and I had no choice. I heard the bells on Christmas Day, their old familiar carols play, and wild and sweet the words repeat, of peace on earth, goodwill to men. Then from each black accursed mouth the cannon thundered in the south, and with the sound the carols drowned, of peace on earth, goodwill to men. It was as if an earthquake rent the hearth stones of a continent, and made forlorn the households born, of peace on earth, goodwill to men. And in despair, I bowed my head. There is no peace on earth, I said. For hate is strong and mocks the song of peace on earth, goodwill to men. I try to be a practical guy. Grounded and whatnot. I try. But let's face it, I'm working with some broken tools, at least emotionally speaking. I didn't sign up to fight because I like the color motif in the flag, and I sure as hell don't give a blind fuck about any political party. I'm not political. I consider myself a patriot, but when it comes down to it, I'm for the people. I know from very personal experience what it means to be helpless or defenseless in the face of powerful aggression and hate. My fight is for the people who can't fight for themselves. That sounds heroic and all that shit, but it's not. Maybe it's me working on some karmic debts, whatever. My team are all like me, battered knights in rusty armor with crooked lances. The windmills we tilt at are intolerance and greed, extremist ideologies, cultural and political madness. We stand together against that, and we have a pretty good track record for kicking ass and taking names. We've saved a lot of lives, sometimes by ending lives, nature of being soldiers. Most days we can sleep okay because we know that we've done our best. And some days the world itself takes a breath and whispers a bit of reassurance. Like the D9 summit coming up in Norway. All nine of the nations who have nuclear weapons have agreed to sit down for serious discussions about significantly reducing their nuclear arsenals. The chat around the water cooler was that this was real, not just the usual political circle jerk. That was a good thing. A sane thing. But some days... sometimes it doesn't feel like we're on a battlefield facing enemies who are as mortal and fragile as we are. Sometimes we don't seem to be awake in a world of sane people who don't want mutually assured destruction to be our defining political strategy. Sometimes it's like we're ankle deep in wet sand, watching as the water is pulled out by forces wildly beyond our own powers. And somewhere out there, just beyond the limits of our vision, something big and dark is rising up, forming a tsunami of such immense destructive blackness that when it hits, none of our bullets, none of our skills, and nothing of who we are will be able to stop it. No soldier wins every battle, because life itself is a battle and no one gets out of that alive, which means that we may fall, no, will fall, with no guarantee that anyone will be there to take our places. I scratched Ghost's head and he looked at me with immense and bottomless brown eyes that were filled with knowing and understanding, and with a resignation and acceptance that was beyond me. The song ended and was replaced with something happier. Someone was rocking around a Christmas tree as if everything was right with the goddamn world. But that other song haunted me, darkening the skies through which we flew. Tired as I was, I didn't sleep at all on the flight. Interlude 2. Area 94, Secure Military Black Site, Triple I, Arizona, 16 months ago.
"I'm pleased to see that the physical therapy is proceeding," said Rudy Sanchez. "Are you in any discomfort?"
Rafael Santoro paused before he answered. He always did that, no matter how basic or inconsequential the question. Rudy knew that this was a tactic refined by long use. The pause suggested that the person about to speak needed time to think, but that was not the case.
"The surgeons lacked commitment," he said. "That's understandable."
He spoke with a pronounced lisp that was likely a permanent souvenir from what had happened. 7 months ago, Santoro stole a spoon from the mess hall, sharpened it, and used it to cut out his own tongue. The prison doctors managed to reattach it, but not well enough. The lisp was a dangerous element for Rudy. It gave Santoro a softness and vulnerability that were entirely false, and it was a source of guilt for Rudy, because after a series of sessions in which they had begun to drill into the reasons Santoro had become aligned with the international criminal empire called the Seven Kings, Rudy had used Santoro's blind and absolute faith in the woman whom the kings called the goddess as a lever to crack Santoro open. The killer was deeply religious and still secretly worshipped her, even though she and all of the kings were dead and the organization destroyed. The king's group was built on the bones of ancient conspiracy theories, adopting rituals and practices that were partly to allow the members to hide their true identities and partly to create a mystique. They used the behavior modification and loyalty-building strategies of a number of history's most successful cults. They had teams of computer experts seed the internet with vague stories of the Seven Kings, and had other teams dive deep into Wikipedia and other online information sites to plant select bits of data. Those computer experts hacked into the host sites to change time codes so that the Seven Kings' mentions appeared to have always been there. They went through thousands of university websites, sneaking past security and changing footnotes and entries in thesis papers. They seeded hundreds of books into the pop culture and conspiracy theory genres, even to the point of influencing revisions of older works published by big houses. It was a long game, taking decades and costing billions, but it worked. At the same time, they had people working social media platforms, influencing conversations, filtering data to the press on both sides of political lines. The kings were not themselves political. Politics was something they could use, as was the media. Rafael Santoro was there for almost all of it. He had been seduced into the church of the goddess Eris and rose to become her greatest apostle. He served Eris's son, Hugo Vaux, who was the king of fear, becoming his conscience, a kind of advisor. Santoro also formed and trained an elite commando group, the Kingsmen. Santoro's worst crimes, though, were not even these things. He was used by the King of Fear to create a program of blackmail and extortion that ruined the lives and corrupted the souls of hundreds of key people in business, the media, politics, and more. During his last project, the Sea of Hope, he attempted to release weaponized Ebola on a charity fundraising cruise ship filled with celebrities and the children of the former president. That same plague would have spread to the mainlands of South and Central America, likely killing many millions. That was Rafael Santoro. The man who sat across from Rudy was only wearing the disguise of weakness and helplessness. His skin had paled to a prison gray, his cheeks were sunken from frequent hunger strikes, and he had that lisp. It was important for Rudy to give himself a perspective check before these sessions because most of the work he did was helping victims of trauma. Santoro was not that, not in any way.
"How are they treating you?"
asked Rudy. Santoro almost smiled. There was a twitch of it on his hard mouth.
"Like I deserve. No, they treat me better than I deserve."
"Because of the things you did?"
"No."
"Then why do you think you deserve harsh treatment?"
"Because of the things I did not do,"
said Santoro. Rudy nodded.
"Because the Seven Kings organization was torn down?"
"You're not a naive man, Dr. Sanchez. You should not pretend that you are."
"Because you did not keep Eris from being killed."
"The goddess,"
corrected Santoro.
"You do understand that the goddess was an affectation, don't you?" asked Rudy. "We've talked about this at length. She was a woman, extraordinary in many ways, but ultimately very human."
"So was Jesus, until he received the Holy Spirit, yet?"
"And you believe that Eris ascended to a higher state at some point?"
"The goddess,"
Santoro said again, reinforcing the correction by speaking very slowly. He was heavily manacled, but he reeked of threat, of promise.
"You believe your goddess ascended," said Rudy, choosing phrasing that would keep the conversation civil.
Santoro studied him, as if assessing the degree of implied insult. After a moment, he nodded, satisfied with the compromise.
"Yes," he said flatly. "She became something much more than human. Anyone who met her would understand that."
"And yet, her son, Hugo, the person who arguably knew her best, betrayed her and killed her. He was her Judas. The boat she was on was blown to splinters, and no bodies were ever recovered."
"Sebastian Galt was fished out of the water,"
said Santoro.
"Or what was left of him."
"He was," conceded Rudy. "But after an exhaustive search by the Coast Guard, no trace of Eris was ever found."
"Which tells you what?"
asked Santoro.
"Which tells me there wasn't enough of her left to find."
"Or that she ascended at the moment of her death."
"I don't think that's reasonable."
Santoro played with the links of his chains for a moment before he replied.
The priest of the temple in Jerusalem turned Jesus over to the Romans. He was betrayed, beaten, humiliated, crucified, and stabbed through the side. He died a mortal man's death and yet rose on the third day. Resurrection happens, Doctor. And don't fool yourself into believing we are no longer living in an age of miracles. As for the goddess, the fact that people who knew her disliked her and refuted her celestial nature does nothing to shake my belief. People are often blind about the things closest to them. Consider Luke chapter 4, verse 24.
Rudy thought about it, then provided the scripture.
Truly I say to you, no prophet is welcome in his hometown.
From your Bible, Doctor.
My Bible? It is my understanding that you are also Catholic.
I was raised Catholic,
said Santoro,
but left that false faith when I found the true religion.
And yet you quote Christian scripture.
Santoro shrugged, an action that made his chains tinkle.
Speak to a man in his own language. The goddess has only been dead for a few years. There is still plenty of time for her apostles to write a new Bible, a true Bible.
Will you write that book? Asked Rudy.
If I did, Dr. Sanchez, I would not be the first apostle to have done so while in chains.
Rudy nodded.
Have you started writing it?
Santoro shrugged.
It is not my time, and I do not have the materials.
I can provide notebooks and pencils.
And while I'm walking in the exercise yard, the guards can photograph what I've written for you.
Would that be a bad thing? A holy book is there to be read, is it not?
Santoro gave him a pitying look.
Sometimes I am impressed by your perceptions and intelligence, Doctor, and sometimes you make me wonder if you are a fool.
Tell me why you think that.
The killer did not meet his eyes and instead spent a long time slowly tracing a circle on the tabletop with a fingertip. When he finally spoke, he did not look at Rudy, but instead stared into the center of the circle he was tracing. Without looking up, he said,
I'll miss you when I'm gone.
Gone? Are you expecting a transfer?
The roaches talk to me, Doctor,
said Santoro. He raised his eyes, and instead of the flickers of madness or malice, Rudy saw a man whose face was filled with hope.
The roaches talk to you?
Yes.
What do they say?
Many things.
Would you be willing to share some of those things with me?
Asked Rudy. At first he did not think the prisoner would answer, which is how many of these sessions ended, with an unpredictable and immovable silence, stopping. Not today, however, for Raphael Santoro leaned close and whispered to Rudy.
They tell me a great change is coming, Dr. Sanchez. They tell me that the world as we know it is coming to its end, and a new world will rise up from it.
Excuse me, said Rudy, mildly, but we have heard that kind of thing before, from Eris, from the goddess, from others too.
That does not change the fact.
Rudy sat back and crossed his legs.
You're a clever man, and a games player. It's always a challenge to know when you are telling me your truth or merely playing a game.
Santoro smiled.
A day will come when you know which is which.
Oh, and how will I recognize that day?
You'll know.
That's unfair, said Rudy. At least, give me a hint.
Santoro thought about it, or seemed to do so. His eyes filled with strange lights, but it was hard to read them. After nearly a full minute, Santoro said,
When the Koreans begin killing each other, he said, then you'll know.
Izmir, Turkey, Part 2. The agony of my feelings allowed me no respite. No incident occurred from which my rage and misery could not extract its food. Frankenstein, Mary Shelley. Chapter 11. Izmir Adnan Menderes Airport, Izmir, Turkey. Havoc team took Astrid to the RTI headquarters, which was on Amphori Island in Greece. I didn't go with them. Instead, I arranged to meet an old friend in the city of Izmir, Turkey, because Bug found a reference to Kuga having met with Assad's agents there. He did some extra digging and built a pretty good case for Arma Kitap Cafe, a trendy little place, to be a regular hangout for people in the more upscale echelon of the Mediterranean black market. So I went to Turkey and was met at the airport by a tall, beautiful, strange, and deeply dangerous woman who I knew only by a code name, Violin. Daughter of Lilith and the top field agent for Arclight. We'd met in Iran when one of her field ops collided with mine. Took us a while to sort out if we were enemies, rivals, or allies. Turned out to be a bit of all three, but when things got interesting over there, we went into battle together. There are only three people I can name who I would never, under any circumstances, want to have to fight. Church is one, Lilith is another, and yeah, Violin is the third. She is dangerous on a different scale than anything that measures me. I'm okay with that. She was waiting for me at baggage claim. Violin is built like a dancer and moves like one, even when she's killing people. Right now she was dressed discreetly in a long-sleeved blouse, full skirt, and a white headscarf over her glossy dark hair. 10 or 15 years ago, women dressed in a more secular European fashion, but Turkey has since shifted to religious conservatism. Violin was not the kind about a custom unless it suited her, and for now discretion was more useful. I hadn't checked a bag and had only a carry-on backpack, so she fell into step beside me as we headed for the exit. Hello, I said.
Hello,
she said, and gave me the briefest of smiles, a microsecond of wicked humor, and a flash of dark eyes. We had some other kinds of history, too. Once upon a time. Nowadays I was with Junie Flynn, and happy to be so, and Violin had picked up a stray by the name of Harry Bolt, who was waiting for us outside by an idling SUV. He looked like a shorter Matt Damon, but a Matt Damon who hadn't seen the inside of a gym since high school. Hey, Joe, he said brightly, offering his hand. I wanted to punch him. Actually, most people want to punch Harry. He has that kind of face. Not actually a bad guy, but deeply inept, awkward, clumsy, and, as far as everyone but Violin seemed to think, a liability in the field. Hey, thanks for using my real first name, I said, taking his hand and doing a moderately good job of grinding his metacarpals to paste. He winced, partly in pain and partly in embarrassment. Fred? Frederick Holman was my cover, had been my cover. Get in the fucking car, I muttered. He got in the fucking car. Violin took shotgun and I glowered from the back seat as Harry pulled into traffic. Harry had some interesting history. His real name was Harcourt Bolton Jr., son of the rather infamous Harcourt Bolton Sr. Daddy had been pretty much my hero. Actually, he'd been hero to most of the JSOC guys in the biz. Bolton was a self-made billionaire, philanthropist, playboy, and behind all of that, the most successful spy the CIA ever produced. He was Batman and Tony Stark and James Bond rolled into one. His list of wins was a mile long. There have been movies based on some of his cases, though with most of the details completely changed. Tom Cruise has played two different versions of him, and Matt Damon played another version. Neither was quite as amazing as the real deal. Except, the real deal turned out to be one of the greatest traitors America has ever had. Made Benedict Arnold look like a natural-born hero. Bolton had used technology stolen from DARPA and some deep-cover black-budget science groups to launch a campaign of murder and terror that came very close to wrecking the country. Many people died. Among the tech he stole was a real, honest-to-God mind-control process that allowed his agents to hijack the minds of several DMS agents, including Top and Bunny. While under Bolton's control, my guys committed a series of brutal murders. I nearly died from a rare form of influenza, and the DMS was very nearly wrecked. Harry was, luckily, not his father's son. He was perhaps the worst CIA case manager in the agency's storied history, and his career was only kept afloat because of who his father was. When the DMS took Daddy down, Harry left the agency. Here's the weirdest part, though. During that case, Harry met Violin, and somehow, they became a thing. I know! I've dealt with some seriously weird science fiction bullshit in my years as a spec ops shooter, but I have never encountered anything as weird as Harry Bolt and Violin as a couple. That just shakes the foundations of reality for me. I could see Harry checking me out in the rearview mirror. He was sweating. "You sweep the car?" I asked him.
"I swept it," said Violin. "It's clean."
"Good. So tell me, how is it you're already here in Turkey? Last I heard, you were making people unhappy in Saudi Arabia."
"Mission creep," she said. "Man plans, God laughs."
She went on to explain that her mother, Lilith, sent her to Riyadh to hunt for some black marketers trying to sell trigger systems for man-portable dirty bombs. The hunt hit a snag when those guys somehow made the Arclight team and decided to set an ambush. As master plans go, it was not a good one because they grossly underestimated who they were setting that trap to catch. Violin, Harry, and three Arclight field operators took it to the black marketers and their hired thugs in very wet and dramatic ways. The plan had been to capture at least one of them and ask a bunch of questions. You do not want details on how Arclight conducts interrogations. Unfortunately, during the fight, one of the hired thugs tried to throw a grenade, but got shot the instant he raised up from cover to throw it. The grenade fell, and the blast took out virtually everyone. The last of the black marketers was mortally wounded and only managed to gasp out a few words, just enough to send Violin to Izmir in hopes of setting a trap for Kuga or one of his senior lieutenants.
"When we are done here," she said, "my mother wants me to go to Oslo, just in case anyone tries to sabotage the D9 summit."
"Does Lilith think that's likely?" Violin shrugged.
"Not really. The security will be massive. People talk, though, and there will be protesters, and protesters are often infiltrated by radicals of the opposing ideology. We may pick up some crumbs of useful intelligence by merging into the crowds and listening to who's complaining the most."
"Long shot," I said.
"Of course it is," said Violin. "And I think it's a bit of punishment for what happened in Riyadh."
"Ah," I said. "Okay, here's what I have." I gave them the latest intel from Bug about possible Kuga sightings at Arma Kitap Cafe. "We even have a possible, and I do mean possible, physical description of our guy." "Wait, you have a description of Kuga?" blurted Harry. "That's fucking cool." "Don't get too excited. Bug says there's only about a 55% chance the description is of Kuga himself. Could easily be a lieutenant. What we have is a good-looking white male, late 50s or early 60s, with a short beard, crooked nose, and dark hair. Wears sunglasses, even indoors. Wears a hat. Wears nice suits, but of local manufacture, which suggests he buys clothes when he's in town. Probably doesn't travel with much because he'd want to fit in wherever he goes. No jewelry except a watch, but we have three different reports on that. Only thing they agree on is that the watch is gold. The guy's weight is approximately 200, broad-shouldered and lean, but moves like he's fit. Sounds like a military contractor who moved up from field ops to management, suggested Harry. Yeah, that was my take too. Violin snorted.
This tells us next to nothing.
Probably the point, I said. Kuga is not a social butterfly. For most of the time we knew about him, he was just a name behind the scenes. Then he wasn't even that for a while. Now he's maybe, taking a more active role in his own operations. Or he's using stand-ins.
Concierge de l'Enfer, mused Harry aloud. That is the most badass nickname in the world.
I'm sure he'd be delighted to know you think so, I said. Go ahead and joke, Joe, but it is really cool.
I need to get a nickname like that, something people call me.
I almost told him a few of the things people called him, but did not. It would be like shooting fish in a barrel. No, worse, it would be merely cruel. Violin opened a small zippered case and handed me a couple of items. The first was an Akdal Ghost TR-01 pistol, which is pretty close to a Glock 17. The Turkish military were now using the Yavuz 16, but most of the street players carried TR-01s. I tucked it into the back of my belt and pocketed two extra 15-round box magazines. Then she handed back a sweet little Wilson Rapid Response folding knife, my personal favorite. I clipped it to the inside of my right pants pocket.
What makes Bug think that he's our guy? Asked Harry.
A couple of oblique references cached from emails and cell calls. References to Plague Man or Mr. Disease.
That's it?
Pretty much, I said. And the fact that people are markedly deferential to him.
Anyone who flashes money and is willing to slip a few hundred here or there will get that, said Violin. Izmir is rife with arms dealers, black marketers, technology brokers, human traffickers, and they all meet in coffee shops. They all dress well because it makes a statement.
Hey, I said, it's what we have and it's more than we've ever had on Kuga.
If it's Kuga.
Sure. And, said Harry, Bug said that he got wind that this guy was going to be there for a meeting today?
Yep.
How sure is he? I shrugged. Not very, but it's what we have. Harry found an open spot and pulled to the curb half a block from the cafe.
On the remote chance that this guy you described is even here, so what? It's not like he'll be carrying ID that says, hey, I'm Hell's concierge.
If he's here, then we'll just let the moment play out.
What's that supposed to mean?
I didn't answer. We got out and went hunting. Chapter 12. Transcript of One World, Two Sides with Jillian Bakshi and Dr. Andy Ming. Hosted by Mitch Greenfield, Bloomberg Television. Greenfield.
Jillian, before the break, you asked if reunification was impossible. Let's stay on that question, but shift the focus to how the political differences could be addressed.
Bakshi.
Well, first, you have to understand the realities of the military situation in the peninsula. South Korea is supported by the United States, as the North is by China. Internally, though, there are decidedly different approaches to the armed forces. For example, in the South, all men of appropriate age are required to serve for 2 years, while in the North it's 10.
Ming.
That would likely change post-reunification.
Bakshi.
Maybe. But consider the challenges of reconciling the militaries themselves. North Korea has a standing army of over 1 million and is believed to have over 7 million of reserves. They have over 1,300 aircraft, not counting 300 helicopters. They have 430-plus combatant vessels and 250 amphibious craft and 70 submarines. On land, they have over 4,000 tanks, nearly 3,000 armored vehicles, and 5,500 rocket launchers designed to deploy multiple rockets. Plus, there are reliable intelligence reports of up to 5,000 tons of chemical weapons.
Greenfield, and nukes, let's not forget those.
Bakshi, we can't. They have an estimated 60 nuclear bombs and a wide range of short-range and intercontinental-range missiles.
Ming.
And in an atmosphere of reunification, the reduction and inspection of those arms would be a major factor.
Bakshi. To what end? Which government will make the call? Can you see the North, which, as we already discussed, is economically depressed, and with an undereducated workforce, willingly give up the one area of superiority they have? Hell, we don't even know where many of those weapons are stockpiled.
Ming.
Sharing that information would have to be a key element of any reunification agreement.
Bakshi. Andy, I don't mean to condescend, but surely you aren't naive enough to think either side would be that willing to open all doors and invite unrestricted inspection?
Ming.
If they are in earnest about creating a single Korea again, then yes.
Bakshi.
Well, that's my point. I don't know that enough of the right people really are hoping for that.
Greenfield.
Are you saying they would oppose its ever occurring?
Bakshi.
I'm saying that I would be amazed, truly dumbfounded, if any reunification plans ever get past a discussion like this. People will talk, people will idealize, and there are plenty of people on both sides of the DMZ who would like their families reunited, but an actual coming together of two such disparate cultures seems unlikely, in the extreme.
Ming.
What about the proposal of a one-country, two-systems arrangement, similar to how China and Hong Kong operate? Hong Kong was allowed to have its own government even after it ceded back to China following the end of British rule.
Bakshi.
That would be closer to likely, but still hard to sell. Kim Jong-un loves control and fears exposure to Western culture. Having two governments but with an open border wouldn't be something that supports his regime.
Greenfield.
East and West Berlin unified when they tore down the wall.
Bakshi.
Did they really? Have you studied the economics of East Berlin in the years since? The unemployment? The unequal employment? The number of children who struggled in schools once they had to learn the more expanded history and other subjects? The Eastern German economy is limping along with few indications that it will change. Some of the money that's flowed from the former West Germany to the former East Germany has gone to do things like rebuilding historic neighborhoods, building new autobahns, and bringing phone networks up to date. But do you know where most of the estimated $2 trillion has gone? Social benefits, such as welfare payments. All of the admittedly good-natured optimism for an economic upswing has failed to yield actual significant or lasting change. That process began 30 years ago, and it was a single city. We're talking about a whole country.
Interlude 3. Area 94, Secure Military Black Site, Triple I, Arizona, 16 months ago.
Dr. Rudy Sanchez frowned.
The roaches told you? What exactly does that mean?
Santoro did not answer that question, but merely gave an enigmatic smile, knowing and sly. Rudy tried another tack.
Then why are you telling me this?
Santoro smiled faintly.
I know that you despise me, Dr. Sanchez. I have no doubt that if you were a killer, as I am a killer, you would want to stab me through the heart. Your friend, Captain Ledger, would kill me without a flicker of hesitation. Murdering me would probably make him happy. And your employer, Mr. Church, almost certainly will kill me, should he ever come to the realization that I will never again assist him in his campaign against the Empire of the Goddess. He does not believe that empire is entirely gone from the earth. He is wise. The seven kings are gone, but there are higher powers and deeper truths than the kingdom of Hugo Vox.
He shook his head.
But you, Dr. Sanchez, are a healer. You are a good man. Even though I can tell you hate me, as you should. You are never rude to me. You do not abuse me. You have never threatened me.
Perhaps I'm in the habit of civility and nothing more, said Rudy.
Perhaps. But even if that is true, it is a pleasant thing. I know that you are aware that I respond to it, and yet you haven't tried to blindside me with it. You use it to try and unlock what I know, but you don't punish me when I obfuscate. You don't wield it like a whip or hold it out like a carrot. Torturers will do that. I have. You do not.
Rudy said nothing.
And so I offer you this one thing, because it is the only form of remittance left to me,
said Santoro. His voice was very soft, the room around them quiet.
What is it you offer, Mr. Santoro? I don't know if I can fully appreciate its value.
It is a warning, Dr. Sanchez. I know that you are married. I can see the ring on your finger. Your sleeve smells of baby formula, so I can infer a child, yes? You have a family, which is something new, because you did not have that when we first came into each other's lives.
Rudy stiffened.
Are you threatening my family?
For a moment, Santoro seemed genuinely surprised.
No, Doctor, I am talking about your safety. You. I'm offering you a warning.
What kind of warning?
Instead of answering directly, the little killer said,
My own wife is long dead. So are both of my children. They died when my village was spurned by men who sought to kill me. They died very badly at the hands of men who understood cruelty, as I have come to understand it.
My God, I'm so sorry.
Santoro shrugged again.
It was a very long time ago. Some of those who committed those crimes were unlucky enough to allow me to find them. I took time with them. A great deal of time.
Rudy wanted to look away from the pain in Santoro's eyes, but he did not. He owed nothing to this man, but he would not look away, and in doing so dishonor the woman and children who had suffered at the hands of monsters.
I was not able to find all of those men,
said Santoro.
I was not able to find the person who sent them after me, but the roaches who come and whisper to me in the night promise that they can help me find all of the murderers who have eluded me.
The roaches tell you this?
Yes.
Why?
Do you now want to know how, or have you already decided that I am insane and this is all academic? Perhaps you think I will make an interesting case study for a report you will file or a paper you will publish if Mr. Church allows you to publish.
My question stands, said Rudy. Why?
Santoro drummed his fingers in silence, making patterns that Rudy assumed were the notes of some piece of music, but each separate tap was shadow soft.
I have been offered a barter,
said the little killer.
They will tell me where the last of the men who killed my family can be found in exchange for my help.
Help doing what, exactly? Do you mean in completing the work begun by the Seven Kings?
Again, Santoro did not answer, but instead said,
The roaches whispered something very important to me, Doctor. They whispered a truth that you did not tell me.
What truth?
They told me that my brother Esteban was dead. They said that he had been murdered by your friend, Joe Ledger.
Rudy said nothing.
They said that Ledger cast him into hell.
As Santoro spoke, his voice became quieter, but his face grew livid. His dark eyes glittered with passion, and spit flew from his lips. Then, all at once, he stopped and sagged back, looking exhausted and even a little surprised by his outburst. He tried to touch his face, but the chains did not reach that far, so he bent and placed his face in his palms. Rudy sat still, watching, assessing, processing. He was troubled and confused. However, before he could ask a question, Santoro spoke again.
My warning is this,
he said quietly.
Do not stand too close to Joe Ledger. Vengeance is coming for him, and when it comes, he will kill everyone. You, Mr. Church, everyone.
He? Asked Rudy. Are you saying that vengeance is a he, or suggesting that Joe Ledger himself is the threat?
Santoro did not speak again, and after 10 silent minutes, Rudy Sanchez rose and left the room. Chapter 13 Armakitap Cafe, Atatürk, Kadesi, No. 312, Alsancak, İzmir, Turkey. I went in first, found a table, and ordered coffee and a couple of pugashas pastries, one filled with feta and the other with blue cheese. No reason I can't have something yummy just because I'm looking for a murderous psychopath. Happy tummy makes for happy Joe Ledger. There were 5 other people in the place, 2 men seated in the window talking about dips and global currencies. Both were dressed in business suits and had that unique blend of harried arrogance that made me think they were stockbrokers. An older man with the most comprehensively wrinkled face I've ever seen, reading a battered copy of Yashar Kemal's Mehmet My Hawk. There had to be 50 yellow and orange post-it notes sticking out of various pages. A teacher, maybe? A black fly crawled on his shoulder, but he did not seem to notice. A middle-aged woman sat primly at a table near the back, filling out a form. I pegged her as someone applying for a job. Which left the last patron, a short guy wearing a dark blue blazer over a white shirt buttoned to the throat and a small white takia skullcap and, unusual for Turkish men, longish hair that covered his ears. He had a heavy beard, shot with gray, and wore a pair of steel-rim reading glasses as he made his way through a copy of Takvim, a conservative newspaper. He made no eye contact and did not glance around, even when the bell above the door tinkled and Harry and Violin came in. None of the patrons fit the description of Kuga. The waitress brought my pastries and refilled my cup. Turkish coffee kicks 10 kinds of ass. Thick as mud, with enough caffeine to make my molecules sing karaoke, and absolutely delicious. The pastries were great, too. If it wasn't for the whole tracking a world-class enabler of terrorism thing, I'd be as happy as a dog rolling in raccoon poop. I took a pack of Camel cigarettes out of my pocket, looking around for a no-smoking sign, didn't see one, and lit one up with a lighter. I don't actually smoke. The cigarettes are phony. They smell like Camels, but are actually an herb blend. I held the butt with 2 fingers, very much in the Eastern European and Middle Eastern style. The listening device was in the cigarette pack, and there was an anteater in the lighter. Anteaters are very sophisticated devices that detect any kind of electronics, including active or passive listening devices. A faint screen display appeared on the plastic wrapper of the cigarette pack, and it told me that there were no bugs in the joint. "Outlaw," said Bug's voice in my ear. "Everyone in there has a cell phone. We're running IDs on them and working on cracking encryption." I tapped the side of the cigarette pack once to acknowledge, then tapped the surface in the 8 o'clock position, indicating where the two men sat relative to me. Bug hummed for a moment and then gave me their names and data. They were, in fact, a stockbroker and a banker. They were also second cousins with nothing particularly hinky in their backgrounds. I tapped the 2 o'clock spot for the old man. "Retired college teacher," said Bug. "Runs a book discussion group at the local mosque. Political, but not in any alarming way. Average for that part of town. Lives above the cafe." 3 o'clock for the bearded man. There was a long pause before Bug replied. "Okay," he said. "Now that's interesting." I saw Violin look up and glance briefly at me. She was on the same comms channel. "Took a bit to decrypt his phone and access his account," said Bug. "His name is Bülent Emirzalioglu, with an address in Istanbul, but..." There was no way for me to tell him to hurry up because I was alone and did not want to make a fake cell call just to hide speaking to him. Violin came to the rescue, though. She leaned over and touched Harry's arm.
"You've had that menu forever now, darling. Stop dawdling."
Harry, true to form, said, "What? I just..." She kicked him discreetly under the table. From the wince he tried to suppress, she hadn't been gentle.
"Yeah, yeah," said Bug, taking her cue. "Listen, at a glance, everything about Emirzalioglu is exactly what you'd expect. Average amount in his bank account, owns his own house and car, donates to his mosque, and has some vaguely anti-American stuff on his Facebook page. All normal for a conservative of his age. Nothing too radical. Nothing violent. No long-winded political rants. Just stuff. Except I don't like it."
Violin touched a random item on the menu.
"And what's wrong with this?"
Harry wisely kept his trap shut.
"Maybe I'm getting jaded in my old age," said Bug, "but it's too neat. Look, I've built a million fake accounts for you guys, and this looks like one of those. Everything looks right, and it establishes the kind of backstory you'd expect for a guy like him, except that it is 100% perfect. And nobody's life is perfect. Even the imperfections, he buys everything with cash or checks and never uses a credit or debit card, is a little too neatly quirky."
I saw Harry mouth the words "neatly quirky."
"So,"
said Violin, pretending to touch another menu item,
"you think this might trigger your allergies?"
"I don't have any," began Harry, but stopped himself and flushed a tomato red. Violin gave me a tiny apologetic smile.
"I may have scowled."
But then the scowl turned into a frown because I noticed Emirzalioglu was still reading the paper, and I tried to recall if he'd turned the page since we'd come in. Pretty sure he hadn't. I crushed out my cigarette and lit another, then tapped the 3 o'clock spot several times. Violin signaled the waitress and put in an order for 2 teas and baklava, then asked where the toilet was. She patted Harry on the shoulder as she rose, indicating that he stay seated and inactive. She had to pass by the table where the small bearded man sat and flashed him a bright and mildly provocative smile. The man smiled back, though his was polite. I watched his face as he did it, though, and saw him make direct eye contact with her.
"Pardon me,"
she said as she moved past.
"Of course," he replied, and I heard the exchange via her body mic, which looked like a mole on her upper lip. She vanished into the bathroom. "Gotcha," I thought. The man had spoken Turkish, but the accent was all wrong. Even in 2 simple words, you can tell if you know how to listen. Languages have always been easy for me. My brother Sean got the math skills, but I pick up languages and accents the way a wool sweater picks up lint. Couldn't tell what his real accent was, but there was no way in hell he was Turkish. Bug caught it too, though he used software to assess the accent.
"You heard that, outlaw?"
I think he's European. Mind reader says Portugal or Spain with a probability in the low 50s. 4% that it's Turkish, so...
He paused.
Emir Zalioglu's passport shows no trips outside of the country. I'm calling phony baloney on this clown.
The bearded man dug his cell phone out of his jacket pocket, looked at the screen, frowned, and then glanced covertly around the room. He looked at Harry Bolt, and then at me, and ignored everyone else. Then he sent a text and put his phone away. His face was unreadable, but the hairs on the back of my neck suddenly stood out stiff as wires. I unobtrusively took the pistol from my belt and laid it on my thigh with my right finger resting on the loop of the trigger guard. Emir Zalioglu stood up and walked slowly toward me. He kept his hands free from his body, palms out, assuring me that he was not armed.
"You think you are very clever, yes?"
he said, not in Turkish but in English, and now I could hear his accent more clearly. Spanish, not North or South American, but the accent of rural Spain. He spoke quietly, though, and no one else in the place seemed to take notice. I used the barrel of my gun to tap lightly on the underside of the table. He nodded without surprise.
"You will not find what you're looking for,"
he said, waving idly to shoo away a buzzing fly.
"Not here and not anywhere you will think to look."
"I found you," I said.
"I am nothing.
I am not him." "Oh, come on now," I chided. "Don't be coy. Call him by his name." There was the smallest flicker on his face, not enough to read, but my gut told me it was a flinch, not a smile.
"And do you think you know his name?"
"Kuga," I said. Now, Emir Zalioglu did smile. It was a very happy little smile, and weirdly there was something familiar about it. But that thought, and just about everything else, vanished suddenly from my head, because the old man at the other table suddenly shot to his feet, threw back his head, and let loose a huge scream.
"You bastards!"
he bellowed. Then he snatched up a fork and charged at Harry Bolt. In the same instant, the two businessmen spilled out of their chairs, overturning their table, and came howling toward me, teeth bared, eyes wild, hands filled with cutlery. One had a knife and fork, and the other had, for some bizarre reason, grabbed a spoon. They rushed at me as Emir Zalioglu backpedaled away, hands up and out, still showing me that he had no weapon, or maybe making a statement that a gun was not his weapon. I whipped my pistol out from under the table, but before I could even point it, the plate glass window behind me suddenly exploded as a storm cloud of heavy machine gun fire began tearing the world apart. Interlude 4. Area 94, secure military black site, Triple I, Arizona, 15 months ago.
The psychiatrist was gone. Dr. Rudy Sanchez's last visit was 1 month ago to the day. Santoro sat in his cell wondering if Sanchez would ever come back. Probably. He had planted a worm in the man's mind. He, or the deacon, would have to come back. They would have to ask more questions. They would need to know. The fact that neither had so far appeared was probably due to some case they were on, saving the world from the wrong people. That amused Santoro. The days passed pleasantly for him, and he enjoyed the power he'd taken. It was a lovely drug, old and familiar, and it felt delicious to know that he had cut into the doctor's calm. Making surgical cuts in the mind was always more satisfying than similar cuts made to flesh. There was a risk, of course, that Sanchez would respond by cutting off all interrogations and visits, but Santoro believed the gamble was worth it. He rarely lost such a bet. If it was up to the doctor, then Santoro was sure that Sanchez would return, and he would be back soon. The deacon was far more patient, subtle, and devious. He could wait. He might wait, letting time and doubt do the bulk of his work. It did not matter either way, though. He knew that they would never let him out of the cage. Having a game to play, even a long-range one, was something to pass the time. It made him feel a flicker of power. When he worked for the Seven Kings, coercion, extortion, and manipulation were his tools. The slivers of information he had given to Sanchez would work their way under the flesh of both men and of others in the DMS.
Yes, that felt good.
So he would wait. Here, in the prison. Here, in the routine that promised no change, no end, no escape. They would never let him leave his cell. To shower, sure. To walk the exercise yard, alone and under guard for 1 hour a day, yes. But Rafael Santoro was positive that he would never walk out of this prison alive. He had been told as much by Mr. Church. He thought about that man and his name. Names. Mr. Church, the Deacon, Saint Germain, the Sexton, Dr. Pope, Colonel Eldritch, so many other names. Santoro knew at least a dozen of them, and he was certain that there were many more, and none of them real, none of them true. If there was a devil in the flesh, then Church was Lucifer himself. Santoro knew and hated him, and he feared the Deacon as he feared no one else, alive or dead. Even the men who had slaughtered his family did not make him afraid. He merely loathed them. Church was something else. In private interview rooms at the previous black site where he'd been held first, Santoro had seen the man's true face. He was certain few other people ever had, certainly no one alive. Church was the devil. He was a monster. Santoro was sure of it. And Church had promised Santoro that this prison would be his life, and it would be his grave. Santoro had only hinted about these things with Dr. Sanchez. He had a suspicion that the psychiatrist did not know who or what he worked for. At night, when he knelt on the cold concrete of his tiny cell and prayed to the ghost of the goddess, he did not pray for salvation or escape. He prayed for sickness to come to the life of Mr. Church, sickness and blight. He prayed for the demons of justice to devour the man's loved ones. He prayed that everyone Church loved, if such a monster was capable of love, would wither and suffer and die. Those prayers gave him strength. His hate gave him power. He believed that if he prayed hard enough and well enough, then the goddess or her saints would hear him. Each day Santoro spent his time reading and thinking and hating. Sometimes he would weep when he thought of how he had failed the goddess. Church somehow knew this and used it against him, tricking him into saying more than he ever wanted to. But when Santoro cut his tongue out of his own mouth, that had stopped the interrogations, at least with Church. The pain of that had been purifying. The Deacon had come to see him only one more time after that. The man seemed to grasp that their conversations were over. Santoro expected a bullet from the cold-eyed bastard. He knew the Church would not plead or bully or offer bribes. They both knew it was over. Instead, Church stood watching him from the foot of Santoro's bed in the prison hospital. He stood like a ghost, saying nothing for a long time, watching. Santoro's mouth was full of stitches, his body shot up with painkillers, his heart turned to stone. The man stood there looking at him with those demon eyes. Santoro could never quite remember for how long. Eventually, even he could not bear the weight of that gaze, and Santoro turned away to look at the wall. When he turned back 10 or 20 minutes later, Mr. Church was gone, vanished without a sound or a trace. Perhaps he had never been there at all. The devil was like that, Santoro knew. Subtle and deceptive and elusive. Dr. Sanchez was a far less devious person. He was an actual good man, a rarity in the world. It pleased Santoro to offer the doctor the warning and he would not break his word. He wouldn't go after Dr. Sanchez, and he hoped the man would steer clear of Ledger. If not, then at least Santoro had tried to warn him. Ledger, Santoro knew, was doomed. The Roaches had told him. The Roaches told him so much. In the days after his last interview with Dr. Sanchez, Santoro refused to speak to anyone, not to guards or the medical staff. He went silent and traveled deep into his own mind. He only resurfaced to talk with the Roaches. They had been silent for a while, too. Then they crawled out of the cracks in the wall and scuttled onto his bed. They covered his chest and face, and they whispered to him, "Tomorrow night," they said, "be ready. Tomorrow night." Chapter 14. Armakitap Cafe, Atatürk Kadesi, number 312, Alsancak, Izmir, Turkey. I dove forward, chased by a thousand hungry teeth of glass. I hit the edge of the table and fell, dragging it with me, turning it as I crashed down on my back, using it as a shield. The bullets tore it to splinters, but I wasn't hit. I rolled sideways to see four men with machine guns walking toward the shattered window. The two businessmen were down already, their chests torn to red ruin. Harry Bolt was down, wrestling with the old schoolteacher, while the woman who'd come to apply for a job was kicking them both. The moment made no sense. Or not enough of it. First things first, though, and I opened up on the four gunmen. I took the closest one in the side of the chest, and the bullets punched all the way through him and into the man next to him. They both staggered but did not go down. The others shifted their barrels and hosed the place, but I was already moving, scuttling like a cockroach across the floor trying not to die. I glanced around for Emir Zelioglu, but he was gone. All I saw was a beard lying on a spray of broken glass. Fuck! The gunman began stepping over the window frame, and I rose up to one knee and fired, but as I did, a second gun opened up behind me, and suddenly Violin was there. She took one man in the face and throat, and I put two into a second guy's head. They went down, and as I swung my gun toward the two injured ones, Violin shot them both, headshots, while walking forward, four up, four down. She pivoted and caught the job applicant by the hair, jerked her back with such force that the woman seemed to fly into the air, then Violin simply tossed her away. The woman hit the floor hard, skidded on the sharp glass, but was instantly on all fours, rising, snarling like an animal. "Watch!" I yelled, but didn't fire because something was wrong about the moment. It wasn't clear if the woman was working for Emir Zelioglu or was somehow caught up in the violence and hysteria of all of this. But as I shot to my feet, the woman ran at Violin, who, cold as an eel, pivoted and shot her in the face. Harry had managed to push the old man off but seemed unable to actually overpower the guy. Violin shot him too. Then the waitress came screaming out of the kitchen, looked around, and ran back. Violin nearly shot her, but paused because this really was hysteria and not another attack. The thunder of our gunfire echoed for a moment, and then a quick and dreadful silence dropped over the cafe. It was an envelope in which the three of us tried to make sense of what just happened. Then the silence was broken as we heard people outside yelling, some screaming and the sound of running feet. "Out!" I yelled, and I grabbed Harry by the shoulder, jerked him to his feet, and propelled him toward the front door. "Go, go, go!" He went. Violin and I followed, giving him ungentle pushes toward the car. In seconds we were driving away, me behind the wheel, Harry dumped in the back, and Violin, gun ready, in the shotgun seat. As we drove, Violin looked at the fake beard I'd snatched up during our exit. "What?" sputtered Harry. "Just happened!" I said nothing and drove. Chapter 15. Burj Al Arab Jumeirah Hotel, Jumeirah Street, Dubai, United Arab Emirates, 4 months ago. They came out of the hotel bar, arms linked, laughing, stumbling, laughing harder.
There was a hilarious confusion with a revolving door and a pause mid-turn for a sloppy kiss. Then they were on the pavement. The man, Edward Dexter, CEO of Dexter Tactical and Dex to all his friends, was having the time of his life. The lady was probably younger than Dex's oldest daughter, but how did that matter? The family was back home in Albany, and that was a long goddamn way from Dubai. Everything was, in point of fact, a long goddamn way from Dubai. The real world was back there, because it certainly wasn't here in the United Arab Emirates. While they waited for the concierge to fetch a cab, Dex hugged the woman to him, trying like hell to remember her name. Angela? No, that wasn't it. Angela was the lobbyist he banged in Singapore. Ellen? Closer. He thought her name started with an E, but Ellen didn't quite fit. He remembered knowing it 3 or 4 martinis back, but with her nibbling his ear like that, he wasn't sure if he could remember his own damn name. The cab arrived, and he shoved some bills at the concierge, and the two of them tumbled into the back seat. The woman, Emily or Edna or whatever, gave the address of her hotel, and before the cab was in gear, Dex had his hand all the way up under her skirt. She had his zipper down, and her fingers were doing really interesting things. The ride was a blur of colored lights whipping past the windows, fueled by his rising need for this woman. She got him so wound up that he had to actually make her stop before he came right there in the cab, and he didn't want to. What he wanted was to get upstairs, pop a Viagra, and then settle down for at least 3 or 4 hours of serious humping. That was the plan. Fuck her cross-eyed and then climb back into a cab and get back to his hotel, get cleaned up, get some sleep, and be bright-eyed and bushy-tailed for the meeting with the Saudi princes tomorrow. Dex had a stack of glossy catalogs featuring 12 new models of urban pacification drones that, with certain pricey extras, could be upgraded for military use. Life, as he saw it, was really fucking grand. They got to her hotel, which was a bit squalid, though by Dubai standards, it would have been on a par with any 4-star hotel in New York. They made out in the elevator and then stumbled along the red-carpeted hall to her door. Inside, they kissed for several heated moments, and then he excused himself to use her bathroom. Once inside, he took the vial of pills from his pocket, popped one, and washed it down with 6 handfuls of water. Then he washed his face, finger-combed his hair, loosened his tie, and left the bathroom, and stopped dead. The big screen TV on the bureau across from the bed was turned on, with the sound all the way down. On the screen was a woman walking a child to a bus stop. The woman was a little younger than the woman whose room this was. The child was 7. It was obvious they did not know they were being filmed. The woman was his youngest daughter, Bailey. The child was his grandson, Tyler. Dex said, "What the fuck?" The woman he'd picked up at the hotel bar sat fully dressed on the edge of the bed. She held a pistol in her hands. Next to her sat a muscular blonde man. He also held a gun. They were both smiling. "Hi," said Adam. Eve just giggled. Chapter 16. Gazileh Kadesi, Izmir, Turkey. Kuga's voice on the phone was cold, calm as ice.
"What went wrong?"
he asked. The bearded man sat in the back seat of a sedan that sped along Gazileh Kadesi. The driver kept it to 3 miles over the posted speed, and the car was a Renault, a make and model so common it was virtually invisible, a family car of the right color, moving with the traffic.
"You saw the camera feed?"
said the man. He rubbed his chin, peeling away the last of the adhesive.
"The big blonde guy," said Kuga. "Was that who I think it was?"
"Yes."
"You're sure?"
"I am certain it was Joe Ledger."
There were rain clouds in the sky, and he leaned close to the glass to look up at them, dark and troubled, boiling slowly together to erase the light of day.
"Did he make you?"
"No."
"How sure are you?"
demanded Kuga.
Certain.
Why are you certain?
He would have reacted differently.
That seemed to wash back and forth between them.
Why was he there? Does he know about the operation? Is he hunting us?
I think, said the bearded man, that he is hunting you. He was with the Arclight woman, the one they call Violin, and the young man I do not know, he may be a...
I know him, said Kuga, and the coldness went colder still.
Who is he?
We can talk about that later. Right now, we need to focus on Ledger. Why was he there?
After a pause, the bearded man said,
Aleppo.
The car drove a whole mile before Kuga said,
Fuck.
It is only a guess, but the timing...
Fuck.
What do you want to do?
We can't shift the timetable, said Kuga. We're already in motion now. We couldn't stop it if we wanted to.
There was a rumble of thunder, and the first fat drop splatted against the windshield and popped on the car's roof. Lightning forked in the sky, splashing the road with blinding white light. The bearded man flinched back as if the entire city were burning inside the fireball of a nuclear explosion. The light stung his eyes. The phone connection crackled as if it too were burning. Then, as the light faded and the rain began to hammer, falling in gray sheets, Kuga said,
I'm going to find whatever and whoever it is that Ledger loves best, and I'm going to tear them apart.
You will turn a madman into a monster.
Kuga's laugh was dark and hard and so damn cold.
You... of all people, should know that everyone has a breaking point. Everyone. Even monsters.
The line went dead. Chapter 17. Barrier Safe House, undisclosed location, Izmir, Turkey. We went to ground at a safe house run by old friends from Barrier, which is the British counterpart of the DMS. The place was empty, but very cleverly placed electronics signaled our arrival, and within a minute the house phone rang. I took the call. Hello, I said neutrally.
What's for lunch?
Asked a female voice. Bangers and mash, I said, using the current day code.
Enjoy your stay.
That was all. I used an anteater to check for bugs and disabled them all, even the ones left by Barrier. Bug would square that with them, and the Brits would understand. Violin made a routine check of the house, and then we all convened in the kitchen. Harry was shaken and embarrassed. Violin looked calm, because she always looked calm, but I knew that she had to be as rattled as I was. I made a pot of coffee while Violin opened a small laptop, which I recognized as an Oracle substation. Oracle was the proprietary computer system used by Arclight and the Mothers of the Fallen. The screen showed a subtly smiling Mona Lisa, which was actually the face of an interactive AI program. Violin spoke to it in a language that maybe six people outside of Arclight could understand. I'm one of them, though I don't think Violin knows that. I played dumb, which is actually easier for me than I'd like to admit. I even whistled while I started the coffee maker and fished in the cabinets for food. Nothing I heard was earth-shaking, though, just Violin logging on and asking for a pickup and forensic analysis of the fake beard. By the time I had lunch ready, she'd shut Oracle down.
Mother won't be happy with how this turned out,
she said, placing the beard carefully onto the table. Mr. Church isn't going to give me a wet, sloppy kiss either, I agreed.
Ew!
Said Harry.
Lilith will find some way to blame you for this debacle,
said Violin. Well, she already hates me, so that's not that big a thing. Harry snorted, but made no comment. Lilith half-assed liked him, but I figured it was more like the affection people have for a mongrel dog rather than as a potential life partner for Violin. Will she still send you to Norway for the D9 thing? I asked.
Oh, probably. We still need a presence there, but I shudder to think where she'll exile me to afterward.
The fact that she was traveling the world with Harry
bolt seemed like enough of a punishment, but I elected not to say so. Instead, I set a cup and a bowl of canned vegetable soup in front of Violin and picked up the beard. She watched me as I examined it. "Might get some DNA off of it," I said.
"There's always that small chance,"
she said, studying me. "We need to get this to a lab." Violin gave me a very thin little smile, and that's when I knew that she knew I'd understood the call.
"Hey," said Harry. "Can someone please tell me what the heck just happened?"
Instead of answering, I tapped my earbud. "Bug, have you finished running facial recognition on Emir Zelioglu?"
"Yes,"
said the voice in my ear. "But you're not going to like it. His hair hid his ears, and the beard and mustache hid jaw shape, mouth contours, and nostrils. We know the beard was fake, and I bet the hair was too. The tinted glasses gave us nothing on his eyes except an iffy measurement." "I'm sorry, Joe, but there's just not enough unique detail."
"Which meant he was trying to disguise himself, knowing that someone might recognize him," said Harry.
"Thank you, Captain Obvious," I said.
"No," protested Harry. "I mean, he couldn't have known we were going to be there, so he was in disguise to meet someone else."
"You think that was actually Kuga himself?" Violin and I exchanged a look, and we both shook our heads at the same time.
"All of the descriptions we've had of Kuga," she said, "said he was tall. This man at best was 5'8".
"Maybe he sometimes wears special shoes to make him look taller," ventured Harry.
"He'd have to have been wearing stilts," I said. "Nah, kid, this guy maybe worked for Kuga, but I don't think that was him."
"Whoever he was," said Bug, "he made you all pretty fast."
"He must have been there to meet someone dangerous," mused Violin. "He had the four shooters outside and the fake patrons who attacked us."
"Yeah," Harry said. "About that, I know I'm not a genius when it comes to reading a situation, but am I the only one who thinks there was something weird with those customers? I mean, if they were there as backup for Emir Zelioglu, then why weren't they strapped? It's not like there was a metal detector at the door. If they were plants, then they could each have had a gun, and instead of Emir Zelioglu needing an army with assault rifles, they could have gotten the drop on us without a fuss."
"Your puppy makes a good point," I said.
"Hey," groused Harry.
"I was thinking the same thing," said Bug. "Those people came after you with cutlery. I mean, come on, one of those guys tried to stab you with a freaking spoon."
Violin, who hadn't seen the start of it because she was in the bathroom, had Harry and me go over everything step by step. I had Bug send the feeds from my body cam to her Oracle station, and we all watched it 6 times.
"Okay," said Harry. "I'm even more freaked out now. Look at how they suddenly go from pretending to be ordinary folks out for coffee to going all ape shit. It's like, bam, instant psychos."
"Yeah, damn it," I said.
We chewed on it for a bit, but it was obvious we stepped into the middle of something else and things just turned sour for us. A line from that old Lightnin' Hopkins song began playing in my head. "Bad luck and trouble, two of my best friends." "Keep working on the facial recognition," I said to Bug. "Voice recognition, too, and maybe we'll get lucky and get something from the beard."
"Lucky?"
asked Violin with a laugh.
"When was the last time you were lucky?"
Chapter 18. Aboard the Soul of Piety, Kiel Canal, River Elbe, Germany. Kuga sat in a leather swivel chair in the galley of the expensive yacht, a glass of whiskey in his hand. The Göttingen Festival Orchestra recording of Handel's Wassermusik played sweetly. Water slapped against the hull, and outside a gull cried its lonely love song, which was answered faintly and far away. He was a tall man, dressed in a dark blue roll-neck sweater and soft gray wool trousers. The heater was on and the galley was warm. It smelled of honeyed rolls and good bourbon. There was a sophisticated computer monitoring setup in a corner of the galley with multiple screens and good sound fidelity. 3 different angles of the same video played out, perfectly synced.
He watched two men and a woman fight for their lives in a Turkish cafe far from where he sat. A small muscle bunched and flexed at the corner of his jaw. When he'd gotten the call that an important meeting at the cafe in Izmir had gone south very dramatically, he directed his people to send all camera feeds to him. The reasonable assumption was that either a rival team had come to cut into his action, something that was always a danger for someone like him, or that some government cops were trying to make a name for themselves. In either case, the bad guy should have been swatted quickly and thoroughly. His very best man was on site. But now, he was watching the video for the 10th time. Yes, his man had controlled the situation as much as possible, but he had not eliminated the threat. Worse, Kuga knew the three people who'd come to the cafe. He knew them each very well. That psychopath Joe Ledger, Violin, the Arclight witch, and the former CIA agent who called himself Harry Bolt. Kuga drank his whiskey, refilled his glass, drank it dry, got more, not even bothering with ice. He froze the images and touched a screen, touched one of the faces. "Damn it," he breathed. He felt something on his face and pawed at it, then stared at his hand, at the wetness of tears that glistened there. "Goddamn son of a bitch," he swore. Kuga sat there for a long time, staring at that one face, letting the tears flow and hating each one of them. He got very, very drunk. Chapter 19. Barrier Safe House, Undisclosed Location, Izmir, Turkey. We stayed at the safe house for a few hours until Bug assured us that there was no active manhunt for us. The barrier runner picked up the beard. Violin and I sat for a while and talked about friends we had in common and people we knew. It was a wistful game of catch-up. Even though we were never officially a couple, there were people who came into our lives around the time we were lovers, and those people defined that time. And there were people who knew both of us, but separately. She asked about Junie, and I told her about the latest stuff Freetech was doing to save the world. Once upon a time, Violin disliked Junie and saw her as a rival, but they bonded during the Code Zero case and have been friends since. Violin asked about my brother Sean, who was a detective in Baltimore. Sean was married to a wonderful woman,